Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll look ahead to Free Comic Book Day, an annual celebration of reading and exploring comics. We'll talk about some of what's available at no charge this year and offer thoughts to help you navigate whether you're an experienced reader of comics or someone who'd just like to give them a try. Then, the internet has made it possible to start from a single cultural bauble and spend hours following all the pathways it opens. Pop culture rabbit holes in our second segment. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Wherever you spend your mornings, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story is, Morning Edition connects you to it. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday on the radio. Find your local station's schedule at npr.org.
It's a week for diversions and distractions of various kinds, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for NPR's website.
And with us this week is Petra Mayer. Petra, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor at NPR Books.
It's always good to have Petra with us. As some of you may know, Saturday, May 2nd is Free Comic Book Day, and on that day, participating comic shops open their doors to give away comics for free. Glenn, you're our comics guy and our guide for this segment, so why don't you start by explaining how Free Comic Book Day works?
Sure. This is the comics industry's annual attempt to reach beyond its built-in reader base, people who've already gotten the virus, and out to the people like you, the people who don't go into comic shops, the people who don't download comics, the people who haven't been in a comic shop in a while or never have been. This year, they're offering 50 free comic books for you to go in the store, and when you go in the store, they will hand you a bunch of them. Now, not every store participates, it's important to know, so you want to go to freecomicbookday.com and type your zip code into the comic book...
Findinator.
Yes. It'll show you where the local participating shop is. Not all comic shop let you pick whatever you want. Some hand you a packet. You can't just go in there like a supermarket sweep. There's 50 comics set aside.
And some of them will be gone,
exactly.
You know, unless you get there at the very beginning of the day at some stores. Some run out.
Right. It always falls near the beginning of May, usually because of how we live now, next to a giant movie coming out, like The Avengers in this case. The better shops really make a whole freaking deal of it. There might be author signings. There might be giveaways. There might be costume contests. If you got a kid, take it. Because they're because
spoken like a true Glenn Weldon.
Yeah, because they kind of do it upright, and it's a lot of fun. But again, there are a lot of different comics. Some of them are for kids. They're all ages books. Some of them are teens. Some of them are teen plus. What does that mean? We can talk about it. And then finally, there's some mature books in this mix. So you want to know a little bit more about the books that are on display before you go, which is why you would probably read an exhausting blog post that I've written that's kind of a guide to all these books. And in prep for it, I gave each of you 5 of the Free Comic Book Day books to kind of peruse and maybe talk about a little bit.
Yep. And so that's what we thought we would do in this first segment. I'm going to go first to Stephen. Stephen, why don't you talk a little bit about what Glenn gave you and how it felt to kind of jump into these books that probably are not necessarily familiar to you?
It's interesting. The sampling that Glenn gave me kind of runs the gamut from self-contained stories to little teaser, like droplets almost, of like what you'd get if you read the first few pages of a comic book about something you don't understand.
Yeah.
So for example, I've got here a sampling of different Pokemon comic books. My kids read these. My kids read they're more in like graphic novel form than in traditional.
Digest form, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My kids tear through them, particularly my 11-year-old daughter. And so it was nice to get a little taste of what she's been doing, minus the comprehension.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
sure. Doesn't mean much to you.
They have nice instructions for lay people, where in manga you read it right to left.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a certain learning curve of even within panels reading from right to left. For me, reading it, I'm flipping through it right now, made about as much sense as Pokemon always does to me,
right.
Which is none.
Sure.
It's like the Tom Lehrer bit about new math. It's so simple that only a child can do it.
Right, sure.
It's introducing this story where, like, X, the kid's name is actually X. You know, he's this amazing Pokemon trainer, but he's in his room because he's a recluse and he doesn't want to come out. And it ends with, like, will he come out of his room? And yep. So it's a little, I would say, action light.
Yeah. You picked up on something very important about Free Comic Book Day. Some publishers choose to put out exactly what you said, these little tastes of everything across their line, which I call samplers. Mm-hmm. And some publishers say, no, we're gonna bet all our money on this. We're going to tell you a full story starring this character. And I call those singles. And it's a different marketing approach, right? Because you're casting a wide net with a sampler, but it's not a very satisfying reading experience. And you don't come away with a strong sense of what you're getting, as opposed to a single, which is just, it's telling a full story, but if you don't care about that story, then they've lost you.
Well, and the one that I absolutely loved, and I'm holding it up, and Glenn is nodding appreciatively because he knows exactly where I'm going with this, is Hip Hop Family Tree, mm-hmm. which is Fantagraphics, which yep. is a terrific, terrific publishing house. They've, even though I was raised by comic book people, I don't necessarily read a lot of them. If I do, they're usually Fantagraphics.
Yep.
I am a huge fan of, I'm a big fan of Chris Ware. I'm a big fan of Daniel Klaus. This thing is wonderful. It's history lessons about hip hop. And you know, beautifully styled in this kind of a 70s look to it. They even fade the pages the way as if you were reading a historical artifact. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you know, an enormous amount of storytelling, and they're exhaustively researched. And there is a little bit of like, that little boy whom nobody loved grew up to be Dr. Dre.
Yep.
You know, but you do in this Free Comic Book Day sampler, this thing is thick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a couple of these here. You know, I've got one here, the Jurassic Strike Force 5.
Which I gave you because it's the best title of all of them.
Yeah.
It is it's a dinosaur fighting squadron or whatever, but the thing is like 8 pages.
Yep.
It's like a flyer that you'd get in the newspaper almost, whereas Hip Hop Family Tree, it's a thick book, and it's full of, not only does it have three very engrossing stories of different eras in hip hop, but then there are these lovely back pages that are just samples of art.
Yep.
A 2-page spread about the, you know, that showing the Wu-Tang Clan. Mm-hmm. And it's really...
It's just done with such style and such humor and such deep, deep knowledge that it's infectious.
They've offered this or a volume of this
yep.
in the past
on
Free Comic Book Day, right?
Yep. And this book has been around for a while because, mm-hmm. I mean, I think they were talking about it at the Eisner Awards that we were at last year.
Yep.
It's been floating around a while, but boy, if you are interested in hip-hop and particularly the origins of hip-hop,
mm-hmm.
the only fact I saw them get wrong that I knew of was they referred to the unknown comic as the unknown comedian. And so
ooh,
that is the extent
esoteric.
Of... That is
Steven
the extent
has
of,
found his level.
That is the extent. I mean, if you're going to reference the unknown comic, you're already in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, right. That's true.
It's true. So, Stephen, that's a couple of the ones that Stephen got. Petra, what did you wind up with?
I've always steered clear of Free Comic Book Day. I guess I'm a terrible snob. My feeling, and okay, I am a terrible snob, is if it's free, there's something wrong with it.
Oh, man.
But then I've been reading comics for a long time. They don't need to draw me in.
Exactly.
So I sort of come at this from the weird perspective of somebody who's a comics fan who never really read the free ones. I can't compare them to anything because I've never looked at them before. So I sort of just judge them on what are they trying to do here and how are they trying to do it. Would I read another volume of this based on
sure.
what I've got here? Even though I am a fan of Doctor Who already and don't need to be drawn in and am predisposed to like this anyhow, or to judge it way more harshly, who
right.
knows? I actually thought that this book did the best job. This is, I guess, what you would call a single, Glenn, although it's a triplet. It's three self-contained
right.
stories
right.
about the three doctors on the cover, and it does a really nice job of, it's got these little vignette factoids throughout it about each doctor and what he's like and
mm-hmm.
what he does, and the adventures themselves sort of range from silly to relatively serious, or as serious as you can get in 5 pages. And because I'm a nerd, I'm noticing where they've ripped off things that have been on the TV series.
Sure. Right, sure. But, so you're sort of into the Doctor Who one.
No, actually, this was my favorite
yeah.
one. I was prepared to be very harsh about it. Although I have read Doctor Who comics before. They're a nice stopgap when the show's not on the
sure.
air and I'm too embarrassed mm-hmm. to read more fanfic.
Can you, what was the, what's the literary adaptation?
Literary, it's something called Hatter M, which
mm-hmm.
is a reworking of Alice in Wonderland.
Well, yeah, it's a spinoff of Frank Bedard's trilogy, The Looking Glass Wars.
So right.
So those characters transposed.
This I am new to. I looked in the back and went, wow, this has been running for 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. It did not. It again is what you would call a single. It's trying to tell a single standalone story about somebody who I guess is the Mad Hatter trying to retrieve Alice from Buckingham Palace before she marries a prince and is lost to the real world, I think.
That old plot, yes.
But it, you know, the art was kind of muddy and the storytelling was elliptical. It really struck me as they tried to be Neil Gaiman and just disappeared into their own brains.
Yeah.
That, as far as I'm concerned, he's the one that kind of pioneered that poetic elliptical style of comic book storytelling with Sandman. And this is definitely ripping that off and not working. It did not work for me. It more or less functions as a standalone story, but my reaction to it is, you bet the farm and lost. I don't want to read this.
Right.
Sure. So
no, that's a perfectly valid response.
Right.
You're coming from a place of deep knowledge and deep comics experience, and it doesn't work for you. That's important.
This one. So here we have Kieran Gillen's Mercury Heat.
Mm-hmm.
And before we get into this, I want to say, what the heck are you doing not working on Immaterial Girl? Get on it. I want to read Phonogram. I don't want to read Cops and Space.
Okay.
But that being said, this is a really interesting approach. He's decided that there's no way that he can tell a standalone story. So he gives you a couple of pages of setup to tell you who this character is and why she's a cop on Mercury. And then the back half of the book is basically an art guide, a notebook. It gives you kind of like, here's her armor, and this is why it looks the way it looks, and this is the way Mercury is set up, and this is how civilization on Mercury works. But I actually thought this was kind of interesting because I'm a world-building geek. As much as I want him to get back to writing Phonogram, this was a really, it actually drew me in and made me care about a cop on Venus.
Well, this is one of my questions, is how many of these, Glenn, are just repurposing existing material versus how many are devising something special that is just for this particular book?
Depends. The bigger houses, the Marvels in your DCs, are writing new stories to kind of give you a taste of what's coming in their big crossover events. But a lot of smaller houses just can't afford to do that, so they just kind of give you a little taste of what they're already doing, or in the case of Hip Hop Family Tree, something that's already been out.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about Lady Justice.
Oh, dear God. Well, I'll hold this up so you can kind of see.
So that the podcast audience can see.
We are looking at a lot of sort of floating lady bodies and a lady who's kind of radiating light and all this business.
This is about a woman, and I don't know the backstory of Lady Justice at all, but this is a standalone story of a woman who has been paralyzed in an accident before we meet her. All she has in her life is her cat and her brothers, who are cops and emergency responders, and her two brothers die. And her two brothers are killed, and she is possessed by a magic blindfold that gives her the power to walk and talk and kick ass and be Lady Justice and revenge herself by beating up men who killed her brother.
So you were not into it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
The history of the character, at least, the character is that it was created by Neil Gaiman, and the first three issues back in 1995 were written by somebody else. So, yeah, there you go. It's Neil Gaiman's Lady Justice in the sense that he created it, but I don't think he's ever actually written her.
Yeah.
People have lots of ideas over the course of a lifetime that some
true.
Work better than others.
That's true. I think the thing that killed this book for me was the depiction of Lady Justice in her previous life as a ballet dancer. Here she is, and I will describe this too. She's performing in Stravinsky's Firebird, and basically she appears to have two melons glued to her chest.
Yeah.
Which, as there everybody is knows, is art. What every ballet dancer needs.
Yeah. There is some of that art.
I did roll this coming up and hit Glenn with
yes,
it. That was
did.
Very
you
satisfying.
Did. You
so.
Did.
Yes, you did.
You know, it's a nice segue.
Yes, it is.
From what Petra was just talking about, because the comics that I got from Glenn were around a bit of a theme.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn gave me a bunch of comics featuring women and girls, both as artists and writers and as characters. Not in every case, both, but whatever. And they sort of run the gamut, right? The first thing that I picked up off of this stack was a sort of a double-sided thing from Drawn and Quarterly,
yay.
Which is a combination of two previews of webcomic collections, right? So one is a Kate Beaton.
Glenn, you gave that to somebody else.
Petra would rather have had this. It is a preview of an upcoming Hark a Vagrant collection from Kate Beaton, somebody we've talked about on this show before. The collection is called Step Aside Pops. So this is just a little tiny glimpse of that. And it's terrific. It's her. If you've ever looked at Kate Beaton at Hark a Vagrant, the stuff she does little sets of comics. She publishes little, it'll be kind of, you know, three or four or six in a little series. There's one in here that's Chopin and Liszt. These are all things that she's done on her site before, but they're being collected in a book that's going to be out later this year. Backing that is a similar preview of a collection of Super Mutant Student Magic Academy, which I also mm-hmm. enjoyed a lot, which is also really a very charming little book. And these are examples of even more self-contained than the singles mm-hmm. because they are really individual webcomics collected. So you get a handful of Hark of Vagrant and a handful of Super Mutant Magic Academy. Really fun. Definitely recommend that. I also really, really liked a book called Terrible Lizard, mm-hmm. which is about a
terrible lizard.
Well, it's about a girl. Not exactly. It's about a girl whose father is a scientist. And what I like about the setup of this book is that it's very traditionally superhero-y comic book setup stuff where her father works for the government and she comes rollerblading or skateboarding, I guess, into the lab and they're in the middle of a big government experiment. And all of a sudden, there's a dinosaur who is kind of conjured through this government experiment, manipulating time and space and so forth. And so now there's a dinosaur in the world of this young girl. I thought this was really charming. This was the one that I immediately was like, I'm going to go look for the trade paperback of that book, of that story, because I would read more of that. And I think I probably will. I enjoyed it a lot. It's exactly the kind of comic that I like in that it is a story that it doesn't rely on, now I'm going to tell a story about a girl.
Right.
It's a story where the young person in the story is a girl.
Because why not?
Because why not? Mm-hmm. There are plenty of ones where it's specifically about that and they're great stories, but I'm happy that they make stories like this where it could be a boy, it could be a girl, it's a girl. Mm-hmm. And I love that story. I really thought that was extremely charming. Glenn also gave me a little book called Motorcycle Samurai, which is, it has a flair of like the post-apocalyptic Western mm-hmm. motorcycle movie, if you were to compare it to films, about a woman who is transporting a hooded figure who is captive on the back of a motorcycle. It's fun.
It's a very cartoony style.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I don't think it grabbed me as much as Terrible Lizard, but then what possibly could grab you as much as Terrible Lizard? I have a little collection called Comics Festival, which probably one of the things that people might be familiar with in it or might hear about in it is a little comic that Cory Doctorow did with an illustrator named Jen Wang. It's about the world of these massive multiplayer role-playing games. And I think if you understood that world better than I do, it would probably mean more to you. Mm-hmm. But it's a whole story about this process of buying things online, spending real money. And then Glenn, because he is sitting there with this.
It's a smirk.
It's a smirk. Mm, I was trying to. I was about to use a phrase that has a scatological word in it, and I realized that I couldn't.
Does it contain the words eating grin?
It does. It contains the words eating and grin. Glenn gave me a double issue from Worlds of Aspen, mm-hmm. which is your basic big boob comic. It's not the most extreme version of big boob comic, but it has a lot of that. And really not much else going on. This is one of these where I started to read it and I was like, am I just done? Like, do I just not? Maybe I just don't get it. And then there's not a lot of story there. It's fantasy figures and women with wings and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. mostly boobs.
And the reason I gave you that is because I wanted to demonstrate the world of comics has come so far since 1992 or whatever with a lot of the books that you were talking about. But there are still 14-year-old boys in the world. And Aspen Comics exists for those 14-year-old boys. It serves them up. There are other places 14-year-old boys can go nowadays to find what they find in Aspen Comics. But Aspen Comics is still putting it out there. So it's important. It's a part of this great varied world. There are some companies doing exactly what they were doing in 1992.
Right. And I think what I really enjoyed about this collection of stuff is it is a really good mix. It's a really good mix of things that feel a little more punky and things that feel a little more mainstream, things that feel a little more what I would think of as like indie but not punky. It's mm-hmm. it's a very nice mix, and definitely Terrible Lizard. Yep. I would read, and I would read the two web comics, and you have a pretty good record with me. I think
good.
A little better than with Petra.
Yeah,
can I borrow the Cory Doctorow one? I feel like the experience of spending too much money buying things in a massively multiplayer game speaks tragically to me.
Of course.
That's
of
awesome.
Course.
I have critiqued the Free Comic Book Day selections in years past, and I've critiqued how it's superheroes traditionally and genre stuff, and there's nothing kind of in the middle. This year is the first year I've started to see a phrase I hate, but literary comics kind of making a presence known. And that's important because it's a huge part of the comics industry. It's a relatively small part if you're comparing it to superheroes, but there's a lot of varied content out there that isn't necessarily, hasn't been reflected on the free comic book table in years past. And now this year, it's starting to be. So that's encouraging.
So other than the stuff that you gave to us, are there things that you would highlight as far as things that are available?
Yeah, but that's what the post is going to be about. A book by Katie Cook called Grunk, A Monster Story, is about this tiny little monster, female monster, who used to live among the monsters, and now she's gone to live with this nerdy girl and her pets. And the writing in this thing, it's an all-ages book, but it's so funny, it's so smart, the dialogue is great, and it's doing something that a lot of these comics don't necessarily do, which is use the comics medium in a way that sets it apart from being a comic. The monster is telling us one story of her background, and we see things that kind of belie what is being said. That's great. That doesn't always have to be that way, but it's fun to use the comics medium like that. There's a book called Cleopatra in Space, which is an all-ages comic, which is about a very young, headstrong Cleopatra being abducted from the ancient Egypt and is transported in the future, where she is called upon to save the galaxy. The story's solid. The art is amazing. It's very expressive, and it's very wonderful. I love Hip Hop Family Tree, of course. I like Comic Festival a lot. I like Terrible Lizard. Divergence is DC's entry, where they're kind of giving a taste of what's going to be happening in their books. And it's notable because Gene Luen Yang, who did Boxers and Saints, and he did American Born Chinese, and a lot of really great books, is going to be writing for Superman soon. And this is a taste we get, and it's filled with jokes, and there's humor and lightness, and that's not something we see in the DC universe lately, so that is a huge sign of great hope. So those are some of the ones that really appealed to me.
Yeah, wonderful. One that I really liked from the stack that I didn't get to before is Thanatos Diver. It's one of these where it's two books in one, and Thanatos Diver was one of these, like, the beginning of a story. You get a taste of the beginning of the story, and that was kind of the one that jumped out at me. It's these two I believe teenage girls who are competing in undersea salvage with each other, and then there's one of them finds something, and it's kind of, is it a MacGuffin? And that story seemed to be building someplace that I wanted to keep reading, and that was one where each time I turned the page, I thought, I hope this isn't the last page.
Yeah.
And so that one I found really charming.
So that worked.
And Glenn, these books are only available on the Saturday for free.
Yeah, most of them sell out, so yeah, or the opposite of sell out. They are picked up.
They go out. So if you're interested in looking these up, a lot of times you can look them up and find them. They won't be free anymore, but you can Google them, and they will all be discussed in Glenn's giant post about Free Comic Book Day. Again, Free Comic Book Day is May 2nd, and you can look at freecomicbookday.com to find your local comic shop that is participating. When we come back, we're going to talk about pop culture rabbit holes. And if you think you know what that's about, you probably do. So stick around.
Hi, I'm Sarah Dixon, and I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. Pop Culture Happy Hour is supported by Squarespace, providing online tools for individuals and businesses to create a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, domains, e-commerce, and more. Squarespace enables people to share their story online in a way that reflects who they are and what they're all about. Visit squarespace.com/popculture for more information and a free trial.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, we talked a lot about comics in the first half of this show, and what we're going to talk about now is, you know, very much along that kind of fandom, deep interest route. We started talking about pop culture rabbit holes, by which we mean the kind of thing where you start to read about something, and then it leads you to something else, and then it leads you to something else. Stephen, are you a guy who wanders down a lot of rabbit holes?
Maybe just a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a teenager, we've talked before on the show about Plan 9 from Outer Space, the Ed Wood classic in scare quotes. I was obsessed with that movie as a kid for a time, and actually thought that I would one day write a book about Ed Wood. And then later on, of course, there's this movie, Ed Wood, and people much more talented than I am did it for me. I remember studying all of the different players in that movie. I have the Criswell Predicts book, which is a fascinating book of predictions of the rest of the 20th century, all of which are wrong. So that's one example as a teenager. I mean, being a teenager really brings this out of people, I think. I was obsessed with Casey Kasem's American Top 40. Eventually, my parents bought me a Billboard subscription, and I remember burrowing so deep into it that at one point I was reading Billboard magazine while riding my bike and managed to plow into the back of a parked car, which I guess would qualify as a rabbit hole. Mm. And I had the experience when I was in like my late 20s, early 30s, kind of during the height of Napster, when I became such a Jeff Buckley fan that I was diving into Napster and bootleg trading to the point where I was like, I would be thrilled if I got some rare recording of a concert in Barcelona where his stage patter was different from his stage patter in some other show. I mean, really, really deep diving into bootleg collecting. What I took away from it, unfortunately, it tended to burn me out on his music a little bit, and I've never quite fully gone back and loved it the way I loved it for the time leading from when that record came out to when he died. But I did find it a very useful experiment and experience in understanding music super fandom and understanding, like, when people love a band, if you approach it as a critic, it's very easy to kind of skim over the passionate intensity of a super fan. And being a super fan of Jeff Buckley for that time gave me a new perspective on writing about music that I found very useful. I think rabbit holes are tremendously useful.
Yeah. One of the things that I think that makes me think when you bring that up is one of the things about super fandom is you go down those rabbit holes, and it's sort of the same thing as being a completist. Mm-hmm. And when you become a completist about someone, especially when you're young, without an adequate understanding that they may not have, like, felt that they were contributing their genius to everything they ever did. So you'll find yourself being like, oh, I should go and get the records by this terrible band this person was in when they were in high school. And it's like, no, you really don't need that. It has very little to do with what they did later.
Well, one of the Jeff Buckley clips I found was him scolding somebody who was bootlegging a show because he hated that so much.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like, not every rabbit hole is really meant to be gone down, I find.
Can I just say also that, though, if you do go down the rabbit hole that far, and yes, I've done it, you get a sense of the way the artist of whom you are a super fan is evolving. And I say this as somebody who has watched every single thing David Tennant has ever been in back to the early 90s, that it does give you a sense of the evolution of an artist, even if you're seeing something that they perhaps did not contribute their full genius to.
No, sure.
Because
absolutely.
I think the popular notion of this is when you become obsessed or with something, when you become a super nerd and you get the whole gamut of somebody's output or whatever, that you're not discerning in any way.
Right.
And that's just not true. It's a great way to develop an aesthetic. It's a great way to understand for yourself, even if you can't articulate it quite, why some things work for you and some things don't. And nerds are opinionated. That's one of the things that they do. And they argue over what's good and what's bad. That's part of this whole deal. For me, obviously, I did it for like Peter Gabriel, I did it for the Talking Heads, I did it for Tolkien, I did it for Neil Gaiman, I did it for Philip Pullman, I did it for Grace Paley, I did it for Philip K. Dick. The idea is you'd read something you love, in the case of novels, books, and you say, this person has a voice that I want to hear a lot of. Mm-hmm. And it does, as Stephen pointed out, it does tend for years later, it makes that voice so familiar to you that you want to get the hell away from it for a while.
You just don't need it as much.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
But for web series, every web series I've ever discovered, because there is this infrastructure, as soon as you're done with the first episode, it's like, you want the next one? That sends you down these rabbit holes. That's how I burned through High Maintenance and The Guild and Husbands, and that's how I discovered Broad City. Pete Holmes, when the Pete Holmes show, he had a talk show back a while ago, and he would do these clips of superheroes going to HR. And saw every one of them within a couple hours, just burned through them. And you learn that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. I think, you know, you guys are talking a lot about really logical rabbit holes, like ones that follow logically from one thing to another. And where this puts my head is in the kind of serendipitous rabbit holes of especially YouTube.
Yeah.
If you look at YouTube, if you go sometime and look at a video on YouTube, look at how many places there are on that page that are inviting you to something else. You can either go to the other things posted by that person or the other things that are about that same thing. But then there's always this column of here's a bunch of other stuff. And sometimes it's really obvious why it's there. And other times it's not really obvious why it's there, but weirdly it'll be like, oh yeah, I would watch that. Mm-hmm. And so I think the internet, this is not me being like, the internet causes everything, but I do think that certain things about linking and certain things about the kind of frictionless way that you can move from one thing to another without picking up another book, without, you know, finding another bootleg, without downloading anything, without even searching for anything, mm-hmm. the next thing will just present itself to you. I think the entire structure of the internet is rabbit hole friendly.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just they know you, you know? Yeah. Sometimes it's just they know you and they know what you're vulnerable to.
I definitely had that experience at one point. The song Oh Sheila by Ready for the World about mm-hmm. 1985 got stuck in my head, and that led me to, there was another Ready for the World hit. It was a ballad, Love You Down. And eventually I spent like 4 hours watching 80s R&B videos on YouTube, which I highly, highly recommend.
Yeah, and I think Twitter is one of the things that has kind of validated the rabbit hole experience, because what will happen is you'll see somebody tweet like, I am currently watching a video of a commercial starring some random person from 1982, and you know that they didn't just go looking for that. Somehow either they were looking at other stuff and it popped up in that column, or they were reading about the person and somebody said, oh, you know, and also, of course, he used to do cornflakes commercials, but never mind. And then you go, well, I'm going to have to go look for the cornflake commercials. And then you suddenly look and look. And there's an episode of the podcast Reply All out of Gimlet where they tell the story of a guy who started to become fascinated with this child commercial actor from the, I think, late 1970s, maybe in early 80s, but kind of from my early childhood. And they wound up investigating sort of what had happened to this dude. And this is everything is so deep now that you can go as deep down that rabbit hole as you like, you know, whatever works.
Yeah, but you're at the mercy, in the case of YouTube, you're at the mercy of the algorithm, and sometimes the algorithm is just screwy. I went through a phase where I was looking at a lot of different Spike Jonze-directed music videos, and then I got like three past Spike Jonze, and I realized that I was just watching stuff that somebody had said weird crap, you know, just right. Like music videos that are weird. I'm like, that's not, I mean, it's cool.
Well, that's the thing, is the rabbit hole will be led by the tagging, and the
exactly.
tagging, the tagging is disturbingly democratic.
And, well, yeah, but you want that, right?
I mean,
you're in there to watch Spike Jonze videos, but if you discover something you would never know to look for, I mean, there's a lot of serendipity in
that. Every time I click, I'm strengthening that algorithm. I'm just that's reinforcing right. it.
No, it's true. It's what they want you to do.
Mm-hmm. That's how they get you.
That's what they want you to think. That's how they get you. So you do it with musicians, Steven. And Glenn, I'm sure you do it with writers.
Yeah, and, you know, reading superhero comic books if you're a child is basically one long going down the rabbit hole, because you get a little taste of something and it says, see issue 17, and then you just have to find issue 17.
Petra talks a lot about being a world-building person, and the whole kind of world-building thing is very rabbit hole-y in the sense that you can wind up... One of the reasons why I don't read certain kinds of books is that I just don't have time to find out. I mean, if Game of Thrones were something that I could read and finish and done with and not have to think about anymore, I'd probably be more likely to do it. I know that it's such a process.
Perversely, that's what keeps me out of mainstream superhero comics is the unbelievably complicated continuity.
You've read Discworld. How many Discworlds?
How many times has the Discworld been rebooted because even the creator couldn't keep track of it?
Yeah.
But this idea, this is why DC started everything over again, right?
Right.
I think I've probably talked before that, you know, my best friend is a very serious Big Two comics fan. She's the one that got like original art of Nightcrawler on her wall because she's obsessed with him. And she periodically tries to get me involved in, you know, like the last time she tried to get me to read Legion of Superheroes because she possesses and wears frequently a genuine Legion of Superheroes flight ring. So I tried it and I got interested in it, and then it was rebooted 4 times. Right. So every time I got into a set of characters, they went away again.
I have had that struggle with interlocking superhero movies. We're going to talk about the Avengers next week, and I'm gearing up. Like, I remember I loved the Avengers, but I don't remember all the story. And so some of these things are freestanding rabbit holes.
This is why the only thing I'm taking into the Avengers, the second Avengers movie, is I remember there's a box.
There's a box.
The box.
Everybody wants the box.
That's, you know, I don't go for the YouTube wormholes, but I do get lost on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a great, like, I got obsessed with looking up the individual X-Men on Wikipedia once. And actually, the AV Club has a feature called Wiki Wormhole, which is just dangerous and bad. Mm-hmm. It's funny, though, because I feel kind of old now because I'm looking at what I put down, and all of my serious rabbit holes are, well, apart from Doctor Who, which you all know about, and I don't need to say any more about that, they're all kind of pre-internet. Like, you know, when I was 13 and obsessed with the Monkees to the point where I tracked down, like, out-of-print VHS tapes and old records. And
but when you were 13, you had time.
Yeah.
I mean, my 14-year-old son just watched 26 seasons of The Amazing Race because when you're 14, you have time to watch 26 seasons of The Amazing Race.
It also becomes like an identifier of you. It also becomes something where, like, you haven't gone down that rabbit hole when other people haven't, makes it something about you. And Stephen and I have sometimes told the story about the fact that not long after we met, he obtained for me via methods DVD copy of the 1980s TV series It's Your Move, starring Jason Bateman, which many people have no idea was a thing. But he sent it to me, he said, for two reasons. First of all, to show that he was cool. Well, three reasons,
I think. Cool.
I think, first of all, to show, like, I'm great. And because he thought it was a fun show. And because he thought that it would be impressive to demonstrate that he thought I would know this show. That it would be like, look how well I know you. I know you want a copy of It's Your Move, which I did.
Yeah, and it's a great show.
It is.
It's Jason Bateman really at like 14.
Well, I guess if we're talking self-definition, I can define myself by the fact that I'm probably one of the only people who owns a copy of Davy Jones's self-published 1987 autobiography, They Made a Monkey Out of Me.
Great title.
Perfect. Well, I am looking forward to hearing about rabbit holes, because I do not think that we are the only people who have been down this road. Please come and tell us your story. Tell us on Twitter, tell us on Facebook, tell us on the blog what your most impressive rabbit hole was. Particularly on Twitter, we are at NPRPCHH, and I love to hear from the folks. When we come back, we are going to be ready for our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So don't go away.
Hi, I'm Terry Morrow, and I'm calling from Clifton, New Jersey. And now we'd like to thank one of our sponsors who helped make today's program possible, Oyster. Oyster would like you to know about their app, where you can subscribe to read as many books as you'd like for a monthly fee. With over 1 million titles in every genre, from Harry Potter to The Goldfinch, Oyster allows you to discover great literature. It's designed to feel personal, with editors' book picks, unique reader themes, and recommendations based on what you like. For a free 30-day trial to Oyster Unlimited, visit oysterbooks.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Between last week's taping and this week's taping, I have been on a whirlwind tour of Boston, Massachusetts and Denver, Colorado for a pair of All Songs Considered appearances. In both cities, one at the Berklee School of Music and one at the Denver Music Summit, we did All Songs Considered listening parties. In addition to meetups with listeners to this show and to All Songs Considered, which were wonderful, we did these listening parties. Bob Boylan hosts them. I'm roving around the crowd with a microphone. And then there are three distinguished panelists from the media, musicians. They turn into these kind of rowdy geysers of ideas and opinions, some of which are better than others, but just lots of fan passion swirling around. And it just, they're kind of designed to make people think about how they interact with music in new and different and interesting ways. And I'm only talking about them because you can actually listen to one of them on All Songs Considered, out today that we're taping this Tuesday. The Boston taping that we did at Berklee, audio of that is on the All Songs Considered podcast feed. And I do actually recommend that show, even though Bob Boylan is the host.
Yeah. We love Bob.
We do love Bob. And I'm curious, partly I recommend it because it's a very interesting conversation full of far-flung ideas. I'm also curious, if people listen to it, Bob was just asking me, if you talk to people who listen to it, when you listen to it and you weren't there, is it interesting to you? I'm asking the Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners who do go down the rabbit hole, see what I did there, of listening to that episode of the show, if you like it, if you don't like it, tell us what you think. If you could go to the Pop Culture Happy Hour Facebook page, or tell me on Twitter or whatever, like, how did it work for you not being in the room? Because Bob is wondering.
All right, great. Excellent. Thank you so much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
We don't talk about visual art a lot on this show for practical reasons, because we were based in D.C. and, you know, exhibits change. So it's like it's not something we can actually necessarily share with people all the time. But there is a permanent museum in Seattle, the great city of Seattle, the Chihuly Art Museum. He is a glass sculptor. This art, when you walk into this building, is not... I was going to say not challenging, but that sounds condescending. What I'm saying is it's not austere. It's not. It doesn't demand much of you because it's doing all the work. It just wants to entertain. It's not aesthetically opaque. It's not opaque at all. It's glass. It's and there are times when you want to stand in front of a Gerhard Richter monochrome gray painting and just contemplate its opacity. And there are times when you just want to be walking through an alien landscape with a bunch of just filled with color and shapes and light. And I am mildly colorblind. And walking into this museum is like what I imagine the rest of you feel like when you see Dorothy step into Oz. Because for me, that's a very muted sort of transition. And as I say, there's nothing subtle about this place. So some places seem like an alien landscape. Some rooms seem like tentacle porn. Doesn't matter. It's just amazing and arresting. And there's this garden right outside it where the shapes and the colors of the plants are matched to the shapes and colors of the glass sculpture. And it's right in the shadow of the Space Needle. So you're not going to have trouble finding it because it's in the most touristy area of Seattle, second most touristy area of Seattle after the fish market. And it's just great. So that's the Chihuly Art Museum. It's great.
All right. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
As usual, it's a book. Although it's a book that I'm a little bit late to the party on because I was avoiding it for reasons that proved stupid. Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, which I had been avoiding because it is a literary post-apocalyptic novel that was nominated for the National Book Award and a bunch of other awards. And I thought, oh, God, because I can be very snotty about literary authors who dip their toe into the sort of murky waters of genre. And just don't commit drives me nuts because, as we've established, I'm a world building person. And so I had sort of been like, oh, I should read this. And then I finally did. And it was just marvelous. It was, I mean, there were parts of it that didn't work. It has a kind of celebrity gossip subplot that I was iffy on. But I thought that she really took the time to understand the way the world that she was envisioning would work and what it would be like to live in it. It jumps around in time a lot. So you go from, it depicts a world that's been destroyed by a pandemic, a flu pandemic. And so she intercuts scenes of the world at various stages after the pandemic with the pandemic as it's happening. And that part of it is genuinely scary. I mean, I can't remember the last time a book actually scared me, but I was reading it and thinking, I really understand what it would be like to watch your world end. You know, what I often harp on with genre fiction is that it has a structure, it has a narrative in the way that a lot of literary novels do not. They can be very internal, they can be very ambiguous, and that's something that doesn't tend to translate when literary authors move into genre fiction. And she, I think, understood that in an interesting way because the narrative was very, it was like an interlocking puzzle piece in a way that kind of, if you read it in a literary novel, it would seem a little pat. But for this, I thought, wow, so this all fits together on so many different levels. And this guy turns up here later. And of course, it's the same person. And this is great because this is what I want. This is exactly what I want from somebody trying genre fiction for the first time. So you probably all already know about this book. I am totally late to the party, but all I can do is give it the official nerd seal of approval. If you haven't read it, go do it. It's really good.
Station 11.
Station 11, Emily St. John Mandel.
Thank you very much, Petra Mayer. Mine is fun this week. We've talked a little bit in the past about Extra Hot Great, which is the roundtable podcast of Previously.tv, which is run by the former owners of Television Without Pity, where I used to write, Sarah Bunting, Tara Ariano, and Dave Cole. There are some similarities between Extra Hot Great and this show, but one thing that they do more of is they have more of a rotating group of regular segments.
Oh, I thought you were going to mention swearing.
Yeah, well, that too. Recently, while I was catching up with their latest stuff, I started fixating on a segment that they call Liv's Face-Off Report. Face-Off is a sci-fi reality competition show about movie makeup and kind of special effects makeup. So it's sort of Top Chef with prosthetic chins and that kind of thing. Liv is Tara's 6-year-old niece. She is the daughter of Tara's sister, Leah. And every week during the recent run of Face Off, which just ended, Leah would sit down with Liv and they would talk about the most recent episode of Face Off. As we enter this clip, Liv is trying to explain a feature of these kind of cowboy characters that the show had asked the artists to create. You should be aware that the way they mix the show, you can also hear Tara cracking up at her niece as they are listening back to this clip, which I think they just get shipped from Leah. So this is my clip of Liv.
Was it just regular cowboys?
No, it was the olden day cowboys.
And
like robotic.
Yep. Do you remember what they called it?
Scampa?
Steampunk?
Steampunk.
Right. And can you describe steampunk?
Steampunk is from the olden days, turning into the days here in robotic form.
Solid. It's pretty.
She's getting there. Solid. She's pretty solid for 6 years old.
She has a better understanding of it than I have.
That's true.
So the amazing thing about these is that Liv is so smart. She's not there to just say ridiculous child things. She's so smart. She picks up really intelligently on things about Face Off, and it is kind of one of those out of the mouths of babes things, but not in a, you know, not in a kind of look at the silly, funny thing that the little child said. She's actually very insightful. And I just became obsessed with these and went through and was listening to a whole bunch of them. So making me happy this week, Liv's Face Off Report, which just wrapped up its run in their most recent episode. The clip that we heard is from their episode 66, Game Recognize Game. Since then, they've done an episode about Orphan Black that wrapped up the run of Face Off. And Liv's wonderful Face-Off report, which I will now need them to replace with something else. And that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the entire show at NPRPCHH. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Steven at IDislikeSteven and Glenn at GHWeldon. You can follow Petra at PetraMatic. You can follow Jessica, our producer, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We're also interested in listening to you, so let us know what you think of this and other NPR podcasts by joining NPR Listens. Tell us what you love and what you love less. Speak up now at nprlistens.org.